Hello and welcome to Sip for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. We've got a packed episode this week looking over the budget, libraries and our returning segment, a member's view of the impact of working from home. But to kick off, Cal Hager joined Rob Whiteman to discuss the spring budget and what it will mean for the public sector.
So thanks for joining us on Sip for Speech today, Rob. Let's dive right in on the big news this week, the 2021 budget. What are your general thoughts on the Chancellor's budget announcement?
General thoughts are that there were no surprises generally, other than maybe the big surprise on corporation tax being a larger increase down the line than was expected. So to unpick that a little bit, we thought there wouldn't be any big spending announcements. This was not going to change the totals of the NHS or education or local government. We thought we would probably get some announcements on pots of money and small sums being made available. So useful announcements that any government wants to make at the present time. But we could tell from what was said beforehand that the basic message that we'll get through COVID, we'll spend what we have to spend, and then we're going to have to rebalance the books in the medium term. That's basically what we got. I think the raising corporation tax was surprising by its degree, and I mean surprising in a way as a good thing. That was boldness from the Chancellor. The decision to freeze allowances in order that we do tax a bit more, but it doesn't feel like a rate increase on income tax, etc. That was in a way a deft hand, slowly putting up the tax take without appearing to put up income tax rates, etc. But the corporation tax increase was more than expected, and I think it will be one to watch. If you look at the last 100 years, the First World War changed the fiscal picture, and after the First World War, tax was a bigger share of national income than beforehand. Then it was sort of stable in the 20s and 30s. And then the Second World War fundamentally made the state bigger in terms of a bigger share of national income. And now tax has been pretty stable for the last 50 years in terms of its share of national income. And it will be very interesting to see what happens. Clearly, the government is willing for and signalling that the tax take can grow a little down the line in order to balance the books, and that is their intention. However, will it work? And lots of commentators have said that if you put corporation tax up, it doesn't much affect yield, and that the amount of tax being collected will be roughly the same. So no real surprises. We knew what was going to come out this week, the central message that we're going to support the economy and the public to get through COVID, but down the line we're going to have to balance the books a bit with some tax increases. Those tax increases being quite deftly handled, the corporation tax issue sticking out a bit as one that will keep being discussed.
Right, and there was a lot of focus yesterday on levelling up. Then many say that the levelling up agenda still hasn't fully been defined yet. What do you think yesterday's announcement mean for the levelling up agenda more broadly?
Still, I think it's still to be defined in terms of what it will fully mean. Clearly, the government wants to level up. We're seeing bits of Whitehall move to other parts of the country. The message that austerity is over, although we have to balance the books, we want to see a more active economy in all parts of the nation rather than some parts of the nation. That is a strong message, but it has yet to be fully defined. SIPFA's worry is that levelling up at the moment seems to come via pots of money being created and bidding for those pots of money. There's a bit of a danger in that, isn't there? There's a twin danger. Firstly, that there's a burden when you have to bid for money rather than all public institutions having the certainty both in policy and funding terms of what they're going to do and then getting on to deliver it. When things have to be bid for, there is an overhead in doing so. And it also means that not all bids will be successful and there's uncertainty about the delivery of the agenda. The second thing is, this is a government that's been under pressure a bit for, you know, giving contracts to its mates and things like that. Levelling up mustn't be seen as doling out money to areas that we like or marginal seats that we want to win again in the red wall. I think levelling up is the correct policy agenda. How that is implemented needs some care from the government going forward, or it may be accused of acting politically in the way that it's levelling up rather than acting with even-handedness and political neutrality. I would be more comfortable if there was a clear policy agenda and that was being backed by resources that are being made available to everybody involved in that agenda. The process of pots and bidding has this twin problem of an additional burden for organisations, but also the risk that it's seen as doling out funds rather than genuinely levelling up.
Right, and building on that point about the clarity of policy, green investment and green jobs were also consistent themes. However, at the same time, policy decisions like the freeze on fuel duty seem to be directly at odds with the UK's green ambitions. How do you think the UK is doing on environmental issues, and how can it best balance the COVID recovery, economic growth, and the drive for net zero? That's kind of an all-in-one question for you.
No, it's a great question. Thank you. The UK wants to be at the forefront of this agenda. There will be economic prosperity for nations that get ahead on the green agenda and build new industries on the back of it. So the government is absolutely right to want to be at the forefront of that. As an aside, we're about to get the response from Bayes on corporate audit reform after the Bryden and Kingman reviews. And I think the government may respond to that audit reform in the way that we're expecting them to about the conduct of audit itself. But it's rumoured that they will also announce changes to non-financial reporting and putting the UK ahead of the rest of the pack on the way that our corporate entities report things like sustainability and non-financial reporting. So clearly, we see a number of issues where the government wants to move forward. At the moment, we're stuck between the way the economy and resources have been used and the way that we want that to happen in the future. So the government has frozen duty because it wants to help the economy to get going again. But actually, that is counterintuitive to all the noises that are being made on building a green and sustainable economy. I think that's to be expected. It's very easy to carp and to find criticism. Let's be fair, we're coming out of a crisis. Survival is probably the first order of the day. The government will want to move on to that agenda, and I think we'll have to be bolder. You know, should we be taxing carbon rather than pushing up corporation tax? Rather than a profit or a tax on profit or investment, should we be taxing the use of the Earth's resources and carbon and creating a different and a new set of incentives for the economy to work on? They're going to be the big, bold things that the government is going to have to do. At the moment, I don't think we can expect big, bold reform just as, we're not even out of this crisis yet. So, yeah, there are inconsistencies on what they're doing on the green agenda, but I think it's welcome that they signalled it as being a key area for UK activity, and we must all, contribute to that debate and try and give them ideas to create the right set of incentives.
A key announcement yesterday for local authorities was the extension of the business rates holiday, though the administration of the scheme has become a bit more complicated. What impacts do you think the business rates holiday and other budget announcements will have on local authorities specifically?
It's probably a little bit like the answer that I've just given on the green economy. It's understandable, the announcements made on business rates. The government is trying to stop businesses falling over. It's a good tool to extend the business rate holiday, and I don't think anybody, local government, CIPFA, nobody has got any criticisms of that. This is expediency that's needed. However, for the medium term, it makes the task of getting local government finance sustainable and right even more challenging. I think we all sense that before COVID, business rate retention was going to be the anchor around which local government finance was built. Once more business rates were retained and the government kept less and let local government keep more of it, there could be a redistribution exercise through fair funding that would hopefully help to pay in part for social care, but some additional social care reform would be needed as well. That looks a bit of a busted flush at the moment. Business rates doesn't look capable of being the anchor around which the future of local government finance is based. And at the same time, of course, remember that council tax is the one tax which is going up. So whilst the government has said it's not pushing up the rates of income tax and it doesn't want to push up those tax rates, it is actually forcing or cajoling or implying that councils have to put council tax up in order to achieve spending power. Local government finance is pretty precarious at the moment. Councils don't really want to put the council tax up. They want the revenue, but they recognise that their communities are suffering hardship and that households are struggling. The gap may get bigger on local government finance because of that, and it may not achieve spending power because it doesn't want to put council tax up, even though invited. At the same time, the business rate base is probably being hollowed out a bit by the fact that there's a holiday and that moving forward, business rates doesn't look like the sort of sustainable tax that it did before any of this. So I think we're, you know, same answer as I gave on sustainability. Applaud the government for its expediency. It's doing the things that it has to do. But really, it means that the issues for the medium term are mounting up and getting bigger.
Just before we wrap things up today, Rob, was there anything that you would have liked to have seen in the budget that wasn't actually there?
Social care, I think. The government is going to have priorities moving forward, but the NHS is funded, education is funded. The question is, are they funded adequately and will the government put more resources into them? It's a different thing with social care, isn't it? Social care is not funded. It is not on a sustainable footing. We don't understand how it's going to be paid for moving forward. It's broken compared to other areas that may get some money and prioritisation down the line. But, you know, we understand how the NHS is funded. We understand how education is funded. We don't understand how social care is funded. And there is a crisis in the market about social care. So I think that was a bit of a glaring hole. I would have liked to have seen the government, in the way that it's given some intent on, we're going to freeze allowances on the main taxes, we're going to push up corporation tax. I would have liked to have seen a signal on where they're going with social care, because I think it's needed. And I think the government does need some new bits of kit and does need to make some bold reform here. Local government can make a good job for decades on something that isn't perfect, but every now and then government has to move in and change the kit. Social care is now in a position where we need government to change the framework and come up with a way that it's funded into the medium term. And I was disappointed that the budget didn't do that yesterday.
So that's about all we have time for today, Rob. Really interesting to hear your perspective. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks. Take care. Bye.
A wide-ranging budget. Great to get some reflections on how it's going to set up the public sector in the year to come. Now, in case you missed it, this week was World Book Day. To mark the occasion, we spoke to Libraries Connected about the important role libraries play in public life.
I am Alison Kroll, and I'm here with Isabel Hunter. She's the chief executive of Libraries Connected. Thanks for joining us, Isabel.
Pleasure.
In celebration of World Book Day, we've asked Isabel if she could join us to discuss the impact that COVID-19 has had on public libraries. Could you just start off by telling us a bit about your organization and the work that you do?
Yeah, so Libraries Connected is a membership body for public libraries in England, Wales, Northern Ireland and the Crown Dependency. We're also funded by the Arts Council as a sector support organisation for public libraries in England. So we provide training, development and support for public libraries and their heads of service and their wider staff teams.
Great, thank you. Could you start by talking about some of the major ways that libraries have been impacted by the pandemic and how they've had to adapt during this time?
Yeah, so like every single aspect of our life, libraries were, you know, really massively affected by the pandemic. It really turned life upside down. On March the 23rd, the government ordered that the doors of libraries must be closed as part of the first lockdown. But what was really incredible was that library staff didn't just go home and sit on their hands. They went away and they worked with incredible determination and innovation to continue to deliver library services, but in different ways. So we saw the development of new services. There was a great flowering of digital innovation. Libraries had been offering e-lending of books and magazines and so on for some time, but we saw a massive surge in e-lending membership, and libraries worked hard to advertise that through social media and other channels to get more people joining up for that service. They also developed a whole new wave of activity of events online. What was interesting there, I think a lot of the events started off as kind of one-way things, maybe some of the easier things to do online, like story times for little children and rhyme times and reading poetry and so on. So something where someone could tune in either at a fixed part of the day or watch a recording and have that connection with their library and that familiarity. But what developed over the weeks and months ahead was a lot more interactive events and a focus not just on sort of broadcasting entertainment to people, if you like, but on doing that really important library job of connecting people. So we saw all sorts of activities starting to happen online, partly as the public as well got more familiar and more confident using technologies like Zoom and Facebook Live and so on. So we saw all sorts of things happening, from book groups and Lego clubs to knit and natter groups to offers to connect people, connect bubbles through social media and familiar tools. Libraries also turn their hands to things, totally new areas of work. About 25% of library staff were redeployed into other emergency activities by their councils. And this is where the skills of library staff were really highly sought. So the fact that library staff know their communities, they're really good at dealing with people, not in a kind of cold transactional way, but in that really human way where library staff really focus on the needs and the personality of each individual. So they made hundreds of thousands of keep in touch calls where they were phoning vulnerable people in the community and vulnerable library users. And this was, in some cases, just phoning up for a friendly chat. But sometimes it was also referring people on to other services, you know, someone who could deliver food to them or get medicines to them or health providers. We also saw things like home library service. Again, another traditional library service, but that really came into its own, where libraries delivered resources to people's doorsteps throughout the pandemic. And the public response to that from home library service customers was, I've actually cried reading some of their letters because they were so moving. And what people valued, of course, they valued the books and the jigsaws and the resources the library bought, but what they really valued above all else was that contact, that friendly, familiar, that kind face of the people they knew from the library, standing at their garden gate, delivering the books, stopping for chat. And there's a lovely story from Gateshead where the chap delivering found out that the elderly gentleman was a keen mandolin player, and he was too. So on the next visit, he turned up with his mandolin and they played a little tune together in the front garden with that, you know, safe social distancing. It's all about making sure that people still had books, still had activities, still had that core library service, but also making sure it was done in a very library way that was about connecting people, caring for their needs, you know, helping them make their lives better in different ways. So really extraordinary innovation overnight and without necessarily a lot of time for deep planning, but a great courage about innovation and delivery, I think.
SIPFA recently released a report about how, in normal times, public libraries have been proven to reduce loneliness. Could you talk about some other ways that libraries are important to health and well-being?
So I think, as I was just saying, the kind of work that libraries did during lockdown, you know, it was a really important strand that was about tackling loneliness and isolation, and, you know, the feeling that many people had really acutely during the lockdown, not being able to see friends and family and not having their usual routines. And that work's going to continue. It's going to be really important for libraries afterwards. And, you know, especially now that we're all becoming aware that loneliness it can cause severe health conditions. People with dementia, their dementia's got worse through lockdown and isolation and loneliness, people's mental health conditions. And all of this it's not only damaging for individuals and their families, it's also, you know, can cause a lot of expense. So any work that libraries can do to mitigate that is really important from so many different angles. So some of the work that libraries are looking at really ramping up after lockdown relates to a wide range of health issues. So interestingly, there's a number of libraries now involved in the Death Cafe movement, and that's where library services can provide safe, and manage places for people to come together and discuss issues around death and bereavement. And of course, the fact that so many people have been bereaved in the most difficult circumstances over the past year, haven't been able to be with their loved ones, haven't been able to mourn properly. You know, you can see how that could be a really important area of work for libraries, to provide that space for individuals to mourn and for communities to come together and have that healing process. But libraries are also important for people's physical health as well. So they've got a very strong track record of a wide range of activities, such as providing healthy food and cooking activities and nutritional information for children and families and individuals, encouraging people to take exercise, again, through activities and provision of information and books. And also we have this wonderful scheme that we manage with the Reading Agency called Reading Well for Health, where libraries can provide books on prescription. So very carefully selected books around particular health topics, so that individuals with those health conditions can be better informed and also read more about how to self-manage and help their conditions.
Okay, great. So could you tell us a bit more about your recent report on how libraries have connected communities during lockdown?
Yeah, so we commissioned a report called Libraries in Lockdown, which looked at the work during the first lockdown. So what was really striking to me was this work of libraries outside their walls. So the doors had to close. So a lot of the work that libraries normally do inside their walls, to bring people in through the doors, to join them together in different groups, or just to be in the same space. It's one of the few spaces in a community where you can be together with all sorts of different people from completely different backgrounds and age groups. So of course all that had to stop because lockdown, the public weren't allowed over the library threshold. So I think the digital work to bring people together, so developing increasingly interactive digital events, has been really important. And that's been allied as well with schemes to help the digitally excluded to get tablets and devices into people's hands, and also to train people the skills to be able to use them. So lots of libraries have had introductory sessions to give people the basics around that. And that's included things like telephone coaching around how to use Zoom or Facebook so that they could connect. You know, these are seen as really, really important ways of connecting people. What's been really important as the restrictions have changed and come and gone is that libraries have been increasingly recognised by the English government as really essential for connecting communities. So in the more recent national restrictions and lockdown, they've been provided with exemptions so that the public can come in and use PCs for essential purposes. And for some people, essential purposes are being able to keep in touch with family and friends. You know, if their family are a long way away, being able to use the computer to email them or connect with them, you know, is really essential for some people. But I think also the way that libraries through lockdown have sought out new partnerships. So we've seen some really interesting work by libraries, partnerships with organisations like food banks or charities. And that's been about getting resources into families' hands, but also, again, providing activities and events and ways that even though people can't be physically close together, they can be brought together in different ways to feel part of something and part of a connected community. And again, the sort of comments, you know, libraries have shared comments from users and local people, and time and time again the comments have been about, you know, thank goodness you've been here, it's made me feel part of a community, you've helped me feel connected to something. You know, libraries really have been that symbol in these very dark times of that people aren't alone, that they are part of a community, and that the library as a physical building but also as something else, something outside its walls and something digitally, that's there for them to look after them and bring them together in a really positive way.
At the end of last year, in 2020, CIPFA released some annual library statistics that revealed spending on British libraries had dropped by nearly 20 million in the last year. Do you think that this trend will continue? And do you have any other predictions for the future of public libraries?
So the financial outlook is difficult. The toll that the pandemic's taken on the economy and public finances can't be underestimated. I think we're just all starting to understand the scale of that now. And we ran a survey asking libraries in the autumn what they thought their budgets would look like in the year ahead, in financial year 2021 to 22. So, of course, at that point, a lot of libraries didn't know. They hadn't had their budgets set. But the outcome was pretty bleak. Some of them were talking about a triple whammy of cuts, of loss of income, and also increased cost due to all the COVID secure measures they've had to implement. And libraries that knew what their budget would look like were predicting a 14% cut. No, that was back in September when we surveyed libraries, and we're about to gather more data from them now because most libraries now do know their budget outlook. So since then, there have been some encouraging signs of potentially a more positive outlook. I think local government's a little bit more positive about its funding due to some of the support from central government, some of the funding to offset the costs of COVID. But also we've heard from some library services how their efforts in lockdown have been recognised by their authorities. And the fact that the government classed them as essential services in the recent restrictions and highlighted things like access to PCs and home library services and the importance of these activities, that's really helped raise their profile in the local authorities. So we have heard of some library services where they've got a much better outlook than they could have hoped for. So we'll wait and see what our survey reveals when we've got that data together in a few weeks' time. But it's also going to be a time of challenge for library services to fully recover services as the pandemic disappears. But I think we've been very clear from the outset that it's not about restoring what was, but it's about building for the future. And the pandemic will leave our society and our communities. We'll be in a totally different shape from before, and there's glaring need, increased poverty, challenge of closing the education gap for children, rebuilding local businesses, you know, a whole range of issues that libraries, along with local authorities, will need to respond to in different needs. So I think it's not just a simple case that it's budget cuts, it's also libraries potentially need investment to develop and really meet the challenges ahead. And what we've been talking about with our members at Libraries Connected is a three-part library service, or a library service that delivers through three channels. So the buildings and all the incredible work that libraries do as physical spaces, as that kind of beacon on the high street to bring people together, you know, physically together and to do that work. So the physical spaces will remain very important. The digital, all the work to build on the incredible digital innovation that's happened over the last few months. How do we retain all those new digital users of libraries? How do we really feed their appetite with more ebooks? How do we grow that incredible new wave of online activities and events? How do we grow that further? And then the third channel is how do libraries deliver outside their doors? So expanding on the work, again, they've done through home library services and partnerships. How do you get the library service out deep into communities, especially to reach those areas of need or to reach new users? Libraries have been delivering a lot through these three channels for a long time, but what might be new is the balance of priorities across these and the need for investment in all three of them. Buildings may need to look different to accommodate ongoing social distancing, to accommodate more partners who want to work with libraries. Digital, we need investment there, including movement on e-licensing so that libraries can offer a richer range of e-titles to their users. And working outside the walls, you know, potentially that also needs investment in people and potentially in physical infrastructure such as pop-up library technology or modern mobile library services. So I think the financial future is going to be challenging, but I think we'll have a better idea of exactly what those challenges will be in a few weeks when we've been able to do a bit of data gathering and analysis with our members to see what the next 12 months are bringing for them.
Great, thank you. That was all really interesting. We'll be looking forward to seeing some of the results of that. Thanks so much again for joining us.
Great, thank you.
You're listening to Sip for Speaks, and thanks again to Libraries Connected for joining us on this episode. Last but not least, I spoke to SIPFA student Faye Reveley as part of our recurring segment exploring the stories of SIPFA members working from home over the last year.
I'm here with Faye Reveley, trainee accountant from Middlesbrough Council. Thank you very much for joining us today, Faye.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how long have you been training with SIPFA?
Just over 2.5 years.
And how long does that mean you've got to go?
Hopefully about a year, obviously providing that pass, you know, pass exams and get through it. But yeah, about a year left now.
Lovely stuff. How are you finding it?
Yeah, no, I'm really enjoying it. Obviously, it's challenging, and you know, it has tested me, you know, mentally and physically sometimes. But the sort of the rewards at the end of it, you know, it's totally worth it. So you know, like I said, the end is near now. I can see it. So hopefully, I'll get there sooner rather than later.
Excellent. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about what the day to day role of a trainee accountant with Middlesbrough looks like, and a bit about your background? What were you doing before you started training to be a CPFA?
I'm 27, but I have actually been doing this as a career now for about 10 years. So I started in private sector and I did the AAT qualification through an apprenticeship. Then after the apprenticeship ended, I moved on to work for the NHS, which was just a whole new world. I just had no idea that there was so many cogs behind public sector and you know, and things like that. So it was really, really interesting. And it had a steep learning curve moving from private sector to NHS. But unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of scope for training in the NHS. It was sort of all hands on deck. We need you in 5 days a week. We have no really sort of flexibility there. And just as I was starting to think about the future, it was just like by magic this job appeared at the local council, and it's the first trainee role that they'd actually sort of put out there for about 20 years. So it was, you know, it's something new for them, and obviously for me it was just perfect timing because I was just ready. I think something that struck me was that I was sort of working towards these roles, but sort of worried and concerned that I'd reached the ceiling because I didn't have that qualification behind me. And obviously SITFA was one of the ones, again, that I was looking at because I was working for public sector. So it just seemed like the natural thing for me to do. So I shifted over from the NHS into local authority, which again, huge steep learning curve. Had no idea that councils had all these departments behind them. I think a lot of people associate local authorities with council tax and bins collected. That's like the only sort of point of contact that most people have with the councils, but there's so much more to it. At the moment, you know, it's great because they're very supportive of having that time to study and making sure that we're, you know, getting the experience that we need as well, that sort of runs alongside that qualification. So it came at the right time for me and my career, and I'm really glad that I made that choice.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. It sounds like everything just kind of worked out at the right time for you. What would you say a typical working day looked like for you before the world changed?
It depended really which area I was working for. So part of the traineeship is that you get moved from, you know, department to department or team to team. Every department ran differently. I had a sort of a key core mentor, if you like, and that person was my training manager and someone that I linked up with regularly. But then obviously I was working for a team and I'd have a line manager in that team as well. My typical day really was just, it started, you know, how I would start is I'd get to know the team and sort of how they worked, and I sort of slotted in really and just had to find my ground with it, and, you know, and try and sort of support where I can, reach for the opportunities if opportunities came up, say, oh, I'd like to get involved in that project. And that was always something that they were quite keen for me to do, and there would always be time made for me to get involved in those types of things as well, which is really good. The other side of that as well was that because I was linking in with that training manager was ensuring that we were also sort of exposed to different types of situations. So we would sort of join in on the finance business partner meeting, for example. We would attend the council meetings. We would attend the budget signed off at the end of the year and things like that. So, you know, we would not only be working in the sort of silo of the team, we would also working with key members of the council and understanding the sort of dynamics of how a council works as well.
So is that mostly office-based, or would you have a more flexible approach to working from home and office pre-COVID?
Pre-COVID, my training manager was very pro-office, and although as a council we already had the agile sort of working, everyone had laptops, we didn't have any PCs, so I was like, wow, this is great, this is really forward thinking. Predominantly, I was only at home if normally a full day of study would mean I would be at home all day. The boss would say, well, there's no point you being in the office. You logging onto a webinar, there's no point you doing your commute and paying for parking to log onto a webinar. Other than that, they were very pro-office. As a trainee, it's so important and so key that you are exposed and around the people that you're sort of gleaming off, if you like, the people that you're going to be sort of striving to be in those positions. You need to be around that to sort of take that on board. Pre-COVID, yeah, this just wasn't the norm.
So what does your typical working day look like now then, if it's completely changed?
Completely changed. I mean, we've come full circle with it, and I feel that although the hardware was in place and they literally we were able to just one day click of fingers and everyone just went home with the laptops, took whatever, the, you know, if they needed a screen, additional screen or whatever, you know, took everything home. The next day we were able to just be online and be working. But I think what's taken a while to get our feet with is how we communicate. It has changed now to sort of the start of lockdown. It was a bit like you were fumbling through it, and we just didn't really know what we were supposed to do, what was going to work. And I think it was year end as well, which was just like the worst time for it to happen. And you can't plan these things, but it did so happen, you know, the key time for the finance team. It was quite difficult at first, but I think that we've found our feet with it now. So, you know, typical days now is we use WebEx, we don't use Teams, but it's very similar. And we have a lot more face-to-face contact, but prior to that, we were just doing a lot of phone calls. I think over time, people really struggled with that and found that it was quite isolating. Even though you were speaking to people over the phone, it's just not the same. It's just not the same as seeing those friendly faces that you used to see every day. So when we started doing more of that, especially the team-wide meeting as well, we did just before Christmas, we started doing that. And that was just fab. It was just so nice to see everybody together. And it sort of just... the morale, it really gives you that sort of like a team bonding type of feeling, which I think that everyone, we all needed to be reminded that we're all here for each other, we're all here to support each other. Where we are now compared to where we were 6 months ago is we're in a lot better place now with how we're working.
Great. I mean, you touched there on a few of the challenges, the COVID situation for you in your kind of working role. What's it been like studying under the current circumstances?
Well, I suppose in one sense, it hasn't changed a lot because when we had a full day study, we used to study from home anyway. But I think what I've struggled with is the switch off. At what point do I switch off from work and do I switch on to study? Even like my study days, I've always put work first, which hasn't always paid off. I've definitely learned from that, and I've sort of, maybe we can call it one of my New Year's resolutions, is that I'm definitely going to find a better balance in that sense, because it's just so important. And something key that my manager had said as well is that actually my role and it's almost when you have a job and you've got your roles and your responsibilities as a trainee, really passing exams and getting that qualification is part of the role and is part of the responsibility. So by doing that, you're actually not helping yourself. You know, you're not achieving your role, if you like, if you're just putting one thing before the other. I mean, something that I've started doing now, which I wasn't before, is completely just taking away everything work related and having it out. I've got a downstairs cupboard, so I just put it in there. And it's like, obviously, I do need my laptop for study, so I can't put my laptop away. But just making sure that I've got a key change and a key switch. Right, this is study time now. I don't want to have anything work related in front of me, and that really helps. I was struggling before to find that balance.
Yeah, I think that's something that quite a few people have been sharing, the difficulty, particularly when the equipment that you've got is in one of your living spaces and you don't get that very clear division between office space and home. Like I said, you've picked up on quite a few of the challenges there, but have there been any benefits or things you've enjoyed about the way things have changed?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've enjoyed not having to commute and not having to pay parking. That's been great. But also, like I say, I suppose in some sense, you get more time. So really, you know, you should be benefiting from that, and you should be, say, for example, when I used to do a commute, I can go out and have a walk now, before I wind down, you know, for the evening. So it sort of gives you that time back. As long as you allow it in, you know, as long as you are making sure you're taking that time, it does give you a little bit of that, like, of that other side of life back, which I think, you know, for me, just me personally, you know, taking a walk and going out is just, it's so helpful, like, to clear my head, refresh my brain, you know, refresh my mind, and just go back and think, right, now I can tackle these questions or whatever, practice exams that I've got in front of me. By working from home, it's allowed that time, you know, to take. So that's been really helpful.
Great. So bringing all of that together, I suppose, if we kind of cast your mind forward to when you're qualified and you're into your full-time accountancy role, given everything that's happened over the last year and everything that is likely set to happen into the next few months as we try and return to any sense of normal, what would your ideal future workplace look like?
I suppose, looking at it from a trainee perspective, if you're striving for roles that are way above at the moment, you do look on people for support. And I suppose for me, like, I learned the most by just being around those conversations, not necessarily being involved in those conversations, but just being around them. That's what I've missed out on. I have missed out on, you know, people have just been calling each other individually. Well, I've missed out on that because I've not been around it. So I think it's really key that, if possible, more office, you know, than home. So I was thinking more like 3 and 2. Past that, Pat, you know, if you're looking at other roles and you know, past your traineeship, once you've sort of found that role that you want to be in, I think that as a team, I think you could work out days where, if you do want to, you know, if you do want to come in, just set up a meeting and just have, and so you're all there together, and, you know, you have that sort of reminder that you're all in this together. But I feel that, you know, people have done really well in getting on board with working from home and actually being able to do the job normally in totally different circumstances. In the future, I think just the flexibility of having an office, a core place you can go with your team and have a meeting face to face if that's what you want to do, but then also having the flexibility to work from home, providing obviously that you can get your job done from home, which fortunately in the type of role that I have, I can do that.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And I think that's about all we've got time for today. It was wonderful to get a student's perspective. So thank you very much, Faye, for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Again, really great to hear from a student about the impact of the pandemic on the public finance profession. That's about all we've got time for this episode. We hope you found it interesting and we'll see you again next time.